Champaign 90.1 FM. This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Elliott Counseling Group, who has been providing compassionate mental health care to the community for nearly 20 years. Elliott Counseling Group offers counseling and behavioral health medication support and management to children, adolescents, and adults of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Charleston, Mattoon, and surrounding communities with visits currently held both in person and via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066. And now stay tuned for today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Nicholas Wyman, president of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation, and he's going to be talking about a 2023 report called Willing and Able, Why It Pays to Hire People with Disabilities. But first, disability news for the week of May 8th, 2023. There was another disturbing article from advocate and journalist Ed McManus this week. According to his report, Bradley Cross, a former worker at the controversial Choate Developmental Center in Anna, Illinois, was indicted last year on two felony counts of aggravated battery against a resident with profound developmental disabilities. Cross was accused of grabbing the man by the hair and punching him in the back of the head with his fists. He accepted a plea bargain, pleading guilty to a misdemeanor charge of disorderly conduct, and was sentenced to 6 months of court supervision. Choate then fired him, and now Cross has asked the court to allow him to withdraw his plea. Cross's lawyer, John Bigler, filed a motion last year to dismiss the battery charges. Illinois law defines battery as, quote, physical contact of an insulting or provoking nature, end quote. The attorney said the resident only has the functional mental capacity of a 15-month-old child, and he contended that only the resident can say whether he was insulted or provoked. The court denied the motion to dismiss in November, citing a decision by the Illinois Appellate Court in a case where the battery victim was unconscious. The appellate court said, quote, the plain language of the statute applies the terms insulting or provoking to the type of contact, not to the reaction of the victim. In other words, the jury should determine if the contact was of the sort that would be insulting or provoking. Whether the victim in fact was able to be insulted or provoked is immaterial. Any person would know that when a defendant kicked the victim, that was physical contact of an insulting or provoking nature at minimum, and the jury was entitled to come to that conclusion. If we were to agree with the defendant, it would produce absurd results. We conclude that the law criminalizing battery protects the sedated person in a hospital bed or a drunk passed out in the gutter in the same manner that it protects other persons in perfect control of their faculties of perception, end quote. 2 years ago, federal officials said they would update regulations to prevent discrimination against people with disabilities from medical providers. Now, disability advocates are pressuring the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to act immediately on updating regulations associated with Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. 30 advocacy groups, in a letter to Susan Rice, who is the director of the White House Domestic Policy Council, and Melanie Fonce-Renier, director of the Office for Civil Rights at HHS, Quote, Section 504 regulations have not been updated for decades and do not adequately address issues facing people with disabilities today. We're concerned that if the notices of proposed rulemaking is not issued imminently, that there will not be sufficient time for meaningful comment and response prior to the end of the administration's first term, end quote. In 2021, HHS put out a request for information on disability discrimination in the healthcare and child welfare systems. Officials noted then that despite Section 504 prohibiting disability discrimination, significant discrimination persisted in both areas. Rachel Klugman-Siegler, a senior advisor for communication at HHS's Office for Civil Rights, said that a proposal was expected in March of 2023, which is passed. And finally, federal Medicaid officials are proposing big changes that they hope will improve access to home and community-based services for people with disabilities, as well as strengthen the direct support workforce. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services, or CMS, issued two proposed rules in the Federal Register last week that would establish historic national standards for access to care, regardless of whether that care is provided through managed care plans or directly by states through fee-for-service. The effort would make changes to the rules governing home and community-based services through what's known as the Ensuring Access to Medicaid Services Regulation, or the Access Rule. Under the new rule, states would be required to reassess and revise service plans for every individual receiving home and community-based services annually. Also, the rule would require that a minimum of 80% of what Medicaid pays for personal care, homemaker, and home health aid services would be used for compensation for the person providing the service rather than for overhead or profit. States would also be required to publish the average hourly rate paid to direct care workers. The regulation also mandates states to report on how long the length of their waiting lists are if people are able to access services when they get a waiver. The regulation also requires new quality measures in their home and community-based services programs by maintaining an electronic incident management system and responding to incidents in a timely manner. The proposed changes come as service providers across the country are struggling to retain support staff. In a survey last fall, it was learned that more than 60% of providers had ended programs and more than 80% said they had denied services to people with disabilities. CMS is also issuing the Managed Care Access, Finance, and Quality Act, which would require states to survey managed care clients regarding their experiences, establish maximum appointment wait time standards, and require states to conduct annual surveys for compliance. According to CMS Administrator Chiquita Brooke LaSure, quote, having health care coverage is fundamental to reducing health disparities, but it must go hand in hand with timely access to services. Connecting these priorities lies at the heart of these proposed rules. With the provisions we've outlined, we're poised to bring Medicaid or children's health insurance program coverage and access in unprecedented ways, a key priority that's long overdue for eligible program participants who still face barriers connecting to care, end quote. Both of the proposed rules are up for public comment until July 3rd on CMS.gov. And that's the news for this week.
These are just the rules and regulations of the birds and the bears, the earth and the trees, not to mention the gods.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Vicki Nyswander. You're listening to Disability Beat, and I have on the phone today my guest, Nicholas Wyman, who is the president of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation, who has recently issued a really interesting report that we're going to be learning more about today. Welcome to the program, Nicholas.
Thanks for having me on the program. Thank you.
Why don't we start with you introducing yourself first, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Institute and the work that you do there.
Sure, absolutely. So I started my career after high school. I actually didn't complete high school, and I really learned that I like to learn through using my head and my hands. And so I've really spent the last three decades looking for opportunities for people to get engaged in different styles of learning and meaningful work and skilled work. And fortunately, companies are still, you know, looking to hire people, but there is this very strange gap. And I spend my working days connecting employees to employers, designing workforce programs, and that's really what's at the heart of IWSI America, which is a non-profit, a 501c3 that actually has heritage back to 40 years ago.
And where is the company based?
So we're based in California, mm-hmm. But we have worked internationally through varying arms and projects, and some of the statistics, or some of the highlights, I should say, we've actually graduated over 20,000 young people globally into apprenticeships, mm-hmm. and we're very excited to share some of that knowledge and that information, and we've got a lot of information contained in our latest report, particularly working with people with disabilities, helping them to, you know, find dream careers. And the message to employers is why it pays to hire people with disabilities.
So how does this, does the Institute often issue reports like this, and it's not all disability related, is it?
No, it's not, but it really is where we're spending the majority of our time and focus. We also work with youth apprenticeships across the country. But I suppose the inspiration for this report and all our reports is we want it to be a practical read. Mm-hmm. My father was an academic. I'm not an academic. He's no longer alive. But he always felt that I had he really described me as a practitioner. So our reports are written from a perspective of an employer, or a parent, or a community group, or even an individual. There's not a lot of technical references. It's designed to be a very practical and useful guide, and we're constantly updating it. We'll be updating the online version with all sorts of links, and we tackle some of the issues which seem, not insurmountable to a lot of people, but it is definitely stopping employers from actually hiring people. They have these biases. Most of them are actually not conscious. Some might be biases. Some might be misconceptions about things like, but how am I going to, get the people to work, or how am I going to deal with this, or how am I going to fund accommodations in the office? So we tackle a lot of those issues. We also look at terminology. But we really try and lead through example of others. So one thing common about all our reports is we feature stories of individuals and companies who've done innovative and interesting things to really move opportunities forward for individuals, and also for the movement of engaging people with disabilities in meaningful work.
It sounds really, really fascinating. So did this start with a survey? Where did you get the information that you gathered for this report?
So we actually spend a lot of time with employers, and we operate some programs with the Department of Rehabilitation in California. And so we've got a lot of interaction with employers, employer groups. And so a lot of the information is coming to us from frontline conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We also undertook some survey work, but it really is very much an experiential report, learning through experiences of others. And it's fantastic when, you know, people would like to, you know, tell their story and break down some of these myths and misconceptions. And one thing that was, you know, I suppose a bit daunting when we started thinking about it was how the whole idea of technology can play a role in assisting. And so there's a great section in there on virtual reality and how that can help solve the training gap.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, a lot of companies, we've got to remember that while this has been going on, we went through COVID where people started using different forms of technology to train.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're making sure that we've got the latest cutting-edge training, be it through a private training provider, a community college, even higher education. There's so many different ways that you can incorporate training into our programs.
Yeah. So what are some of the discoveries that you made that were, first of all, the things that you expected to hear, but also some of the things that weren't expected?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things that I've always had in my subconscious, and we've actually done something about this. When I started on this journey over a decade ago, I realized that we were working with so many people, particularly in their mid to late 20s, early 30s, and they just had not successfully made that school-to-work transition. So mm-hmm. one of the areas of focus, we've just launched a new initiative in California called Career Launchpad, and that's really going to be helping school leavers with a disability to launch rewarding careers. And we'll be able to offer not only some technical support and career advice, but some practical experiential learning, so summer camps and all sorts of ways that people can actually get a taste for what it's like to work in a particular industry. So that was something that I did notice and always wanted to do something about. And I must say, I used COVID to really think about how we could get that message out. You know, things that I was expecting or common things that I hear from employers. Sadly, I have a lot of people who say, Nick, I really love what you do. It's fantastic. What an amazing initiative or what amazing programs and projects, but not for our company because, and they start with this long list of why not. And I actually really like that as a place to start the conversation, because whatever the barriers are, whatever the reasons are that you know, employers are potentially leaving huge you know, numbers of available people sitting on the sidelines. There's all this talent, yet every other day we hear about employers struggling to find people to fill jobs. And I've really drilled into that in the report and said, well, you know, why is that? And I think one thing that probably frustrates me a little is the status quo in a lot of companies that you say, but why is that a requirement of this particular job or this function?
Mm-hmm.
And the person looks at you and says, oh, because sort of that's how it was when I got here.
Exactly.
And you start to drill backwards and go backwards. There's actually no logical reason. So I really love working with employers who are open-minded and, you know, realize that that I suppose COVID was an opportunity to, as a contextual marker, draw a line in the sand and say, let's think of a different way to bring people into our organization.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of companies are talking about diversity and inclusion, and you know, I really like to see those that you know, really commit through a program. And you know, it was really interesting in one of the news stories I just heard. You know, really kind of resonates with me about wonderful programs that through lack of funding just So one of the things that, you know, we try to build into our programs as far as possible is sustainability, and look at all, you know, look at different ways that we can actually fund and support and substitute. So they're not just reliant on one funding source. And I know that's not possible for everyone, but it is such a shame when you see a wonderful program stop through lack of funding.
Yeah, it is a shame. So without going into great and gory detail with the barriers, let's just kind of identify some of the most common things that employers will say to you to, you know, stop you in your tracks.
As I mentioned, quite often it is a discussion about you know, transportation. It becomes a very kind of logistics focused conversation. It immediately goes to that sort of conversation. And I, you know, listen for a little bit, and then I'd say, no matter what the barriers are, list them all for me, list all your concerns. And let's work out a way to work our way around that. And I really have enjoyed working with the DOR in California, and so refreshing when you're working with agencies who have a similar mantra, which is whatever the issues are, let us know and we'll find a way. I had someone call me just recently about a potential program with veterans with a disability, and there was a you know, fairly significant issue in sort of transitioning. And I didn't know the answer, but I did know of where to get the answer from. I know some folks at a public policy institute in DC and was able to talk to them. So through networks, you can always work through these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But the first step is actually getting employers to start the conversation. So that's one example. I think there's another misconception that companies don't have. They try and describe to me they don't have the resources or the structure to supervise and manage. And I really, once again, I start to come back and say, well, it really depends on the type of program that you'd like to run. So recently we talked to an organization in CNC machining. And what we realised is that they had fairly, you know, fairly significant high turnover of employees, and it turned out by implementing a mentoring program that really is a great benefit to the employee. But from an employer's perspective, it's actually smart, because it's actually protecting your investment, because we don't just want to get people jobs; we want them to keep the job. So mentoring is probably something that I'd recommend to everyone listening, particularly, you know, employers. If you're thinking of designing a program, I wouldn't implement any program unless it had some sort of mentoring, and preferably some sort of external mentoring, not just the supervisor, somebody who the employee can talk to and work through issues just while they're getting settled in.
All otherwise known in the field as a natural support. You know?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. But isn't it interesting how quite often things that are fairly intuitive, everything gets so complex, if you know what I mean. And so there's, if you look in the report, I'd say there's nothing in there that hasn't been discussed or hasn't been discovered. There's no secret sauce, as it were. What it really is just getting logical things and sequencing them in a certain way. And I think, you know, the power of working with communities and community organisations, partnerships is something that we really talk a lot about in the report and in our day-to-day life. That's a great way to, you know, achieve success.
So before we run out of time for this, I want you to answer the question, why does it pay to hire people with disabilities?
The absolute answer to that is that employers have promising projects sitting on the shelf, and they're saying, we can't find people with the skills we need. Having a skilled and trained workforce, and particularly tapping into huge, vast talent pools with people sitting on the sidelines makes economic sense. It's good for business. It's good for our community. It's great for the economy. And if any employers wanted to reach out to me, my Twitter handle is Nicholas_Wyman. I'd love to get a direct message, or people can find us at IWSIAmerica.org, where these reports are available at no cost. And even if it's just pointing someone in the right direction, we've got a lot of people around the country, a lot of networks who can really help you, whether you're someone looking to start a skills-based career or whether you're actually looking to hire somebody with a disability. No matter what the challenge is, we'd love to hear from you. And no matter which part of the country you're listening to this in, the first step forward is just reaching out to us, and we'll see what we can do. But it really is just, as you know, it's just about this sense of well-meaning work. I really, there's a lot of organisations who I appreciate, you know, offer employment opportunities. We're really raising the bar and saying we want to look at this vast array of careers and opportunities. And just to finish with one example, Southern California, we've just launched a program. It's an apprenticeship program, an earn and learn apprenticeship program. And we've placed about, I think we're sitting on 60, this has only been running for a year, but 60 people into full-time apprenticeships. Our target is 100 to create 100 apprenticeships, and they're in medical and pharmaceutical in Orange County. So we've picked one region, one industry, and we've got some fantastic occupations there: dental technicians, medical billers and coders, all sorts of massage therapists. We have some vision impaired people who are actually undertaking massage therapy, and we'll end up working in hospitals within the region. So there's so many wonderful career options. So, you know, I really hope that, you know, that employers say, wow, I didn't realize there's just so many options available.
Yeah. And just breaking down those barriers and getting employers to know that it's not about disability as this thing. It's not a cloud out there that you have to deal with every yes. kind of disability there is. It's this person, this one person yes. who has the characteristics and the talents and the abilities that can succeed on this job.
Yes, absolutely. And I, you know, with that, there's I was at a panel of four younger people. They're probably in their 20s, and one of the apprentices from the Ready, Willing, and Able program, Joy, who's just recently started an apprenticeship as a medical biller and coder. There was probably 100 business people in the room, and these four young people had everybody absolutely on the edge of their seats when they were talking about all the amazing things that they're doing every day. There was one gentleman who was had something to do with, he was some sort of machining type of apprenticeship, where he was actually making components for a piece of a telescope that was launched into space. Just incredible stuff. And I think it really is very much all about, as you say, about the individual. And I think that, you know, it's a great place to start. Wonderful.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me today. Nicholas Wyman, President of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation. You're doing great work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the program. Really enjoyed it.
No problem. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week. No, I'll stand my ground. Won't be turned around. And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Coming up next is Food Sleuth Radio and lots of great programming all evening long.